So good evening, everybody. We know that we're in the middle of the parshios of Tazria and Metzora, which describe the tsarua. They describe the Metzora who has tzara'as, which to most of us is something that is somewhat obscure. It's somewhat esoteric. We really do not practice nowadays the laws of tzara'as, even though they are outlined in Chumash. And if you speak to a dermatologist, they will tell you that they've seen many skin conditions that seem somewhat similar to the description that is given in Chumash. But something that we need to take a lesson from. Obviously, we read this parsha every year. It must be relevant to us, even at a time like ours. And we need to ask ourselves, as we read the story of the Metzora, what relevance does it actually have to our lives here in 2022? So something that I noticed, and I was thinking a lot about last week, was that we find a somewhat unusual characteristic of the story of the Metzora. You have somebody who thinks they have tzara'as, they're not exactly sure, they're in doubt, they have a dilemma. And for some reason, this is something very unusual, that we tell them to go to a kohen. You see, generally when we have a doubt, when we have a question in the community or as an individual, we know that we seek out the greatest Talmud Chacham, we seek out the greatest Torah scholar, the greatest sage. Why do we go to a kohen? What credentials does a kohen have? Why is he the one who's chosen to determine whether or not this in fact is tzara'as, whether the person is tameh, whether they are not tameh, whether they're allowed to stay at home, or perhaps they have to leave? That is a question that is raised by many mefarshim on Chumash. And perhaps the answer goes as follows. When we tell a mitzora, when we tell somebody who has tzara'as, badad yeshev mechutz lamachane moshavo, when we declare on someone that he has to go outside of the encampment, he's not allowed to stay in his home, he has to be all alone, he's not allowed to interact with others, that is a painful, that is a very difficult decision that needs to be made. And we need to figure out, before excommunicating anyone, before sending them away, and before excluding them from our community, we need to figure out, who is the right person to do that? It has to be the one who lives his entire life as being an Ohev Shalom, Verodev Shalom. It has to be the person who comes from the family of Aaron HaKohen, who spends his entire life loving other people, including other people, showing how much he understands and he embraces other people. It is that individual who's singled out to be the one to make this determination, this painful determination, that the Metzora needs to leave his home and go outside of the encampment. Because we need somebody who has a pure, unadulterated vision. Somebody who we know is going to give us a pristine opinion that is based on truth and fact, and with no personal opinion involved in that decision-making process. It's similar to a comment that some of Farshim say. We daven Shmona Esrei every day, and the original text of Shmona Esrei was 18 brachos. That is why it's referred to as the Shmona Esrei. And then later on in history, there came a time where there were all kinds of agitators inside the Jewish community, and they were making all kinds of trouble for the traditional community. And it came to a point where they had to pen a new bracha, they had to add an additional bracha, V'lam al shinim, where they ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take out his retribution against these people, and to somehow eradicate their issues from our community. So the Gemara says that all the Chachamim sat around in a room, and they're trying to figure out who's going to write the bracha, and instinctively, all of them turn to Shmuel HaKatan, and they all decide that he's the one who's going to be chosen to write this bracha of Olam Al Shinim. What is so unique about Shmuel? Everybody in the room could have penned this bracha. And what is special about him is, we have a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos where Shmuel HaKatan himself tells us, Binefol o yivcha al tismach. Do not rejoice even if you have someone who is your enemy. Do not rejoice and don't revel in his failure. That person is still a person, and we value and we appreciate them as much as I may not agree with that person. But Shmuel HaKatan taught us, as much as I don't like someone, as much as we may have very different views, we can still value them. We can still respect them. It is Shmuel HaKatan who was the one singled out to write this bracha when it had to be written. It's a painful bracha to say, V'lam al shinim. We don't like to say this or declare it about anyone. But when it has to be done, it's going to be done by the perfect person who already has made us understand that the foundation of his life is one of understanding, one of acceptance, one of embracing others, one of really appreciating the opinions and the values that others stand for. And that is the one who they singled out to be the author of the Bracha of Olam Al Shinim, similar to the Kohen who was singled out in our Parsha, to deem someone a Metzora, to deem someone a Tzarua, who has to go out of the community. I thought about this a lot last week, because at one point, I was in the streets of Yerushalayim. Somebody bumped into me. He says, "Rabbi, what are you doing here? I didn't know you were coming." I said, "I didn't know I was coming either." And he says, "So what are you here for?" And I told him that I was here with a small group of people who were doing very valuable activities with the Ukrainian refugees who are in Eretz Israel now. And he said to me, "Who said they're even Jewish? Why are you spending your time on this?" He didn't mean it in a bad way at all. But I took great offense to that comment. While it's a very important discussion that's going to have to be had about the status, mihu ha-Yehudi, who of these refugees really is Jewish and who is not, and whether or not they can marry into other families in the Jewish community in Israel, or maybe they cannot, or maybe we have to do a gerus. All of those are very important discussions. Very, very critical conversations that need to take place, and someone's going to have to make that determination. But before we get into any of those details, I think it's important that we make a foundation for ourselves. It's important that we establish that we are a people who are interested in showing how compassionate we are. That we're a people who are interested in showing that we're generous, that we're charitable, that we're understanding, that we care, that we're passionate, that we're thoughtful of all those who are going through a difficult time. It doesn't matter if they're Jewish, it doesn't matter if they're not. That's a conversation that needs to happen later. I told him, "I assure you, none of them are getting married tomorrow. You don't have to worry about it. Right now, nobody's thinking about getting married. We'll worry about this problem in a few days or a few weeks or a few months from now. The main focus right now needs to be that we make sure that we have a firm foundation of people who are Oif Shalom, Verodev Shalom, people who show that we have compassion and mercy and understanding for those in the world who are going through great tragedy and those who are having tremendous difficulty in their own lives." So I'd like to begin this evening, Shira, and I thank you all for coming. I want to begin with a powerful letter that is on the handout there. Just to give it a little bit of context, I'm going to briefly share with you the story behind it. It's a story that all of us are familiar with. On August 1st, 2014, just 2 hours after Hamas had agreed to a UN, United States, brokered ceasefire, there were three Israeli soldiers who were captured by terrorists from a tunnel that was located in a basement in Gaza. The terrorists killed these soldiers. They shot Hadar Golden, who was one of them, who at the time was a 23-year-old lieutenant as part of the Givati Brigade, which is an elite combat unit in the IDF. They dragged him into the tunnel and kidnapped him. Since that time, here we are more than 2,800 days later, and Hamas has still unlawfully not released his body for Jewish burial. And many of us, I'm sure, have heard the campaigns and all the work that his family is doing to try and get some closure for this terrible, terrible thing that was done to their son. So just 5 years prior to his murder, Hadar was only 18 years old, and he served as a madrich. He was a counselor for a group of young teenagers in the Bnei Akiva movement in Kfar Saba. And at the time, he had written a letter to all of his students as they were in between Purim and Pesach. And he sent out this letter in anticipation for Pesach, trying to help them get in the right frame of mind, to try to get them to think differently as they were entering this time of year of celebrating Zman Chayruseinu. So let's see what he writes together. Tov, Avarnu es HaPurim, he says, "We have now traveled, we have traversed through the experience of Purim. Va'anachnu mamash lefnei Pesach. Now we positioned ourselves right before Pesach. We're about to celebrate. Hadavar amyuchad lePurim ulePesach. What is unique, what is singular about both Purim as well as Pesach, is sheshneihem meleim b'sipurim, that both of these holidays, both of these very festive times, are filled with stories. But in truth," he says, "anachnu kulanu nihiyim misaprei sipurim." This is not something that is limited to Purim or to Pesach. All of us are storytellers. All of us have the ability to tell a story. B'Purim, he says, Sipur HaMegillah, obviously on Purim we think a lot and we focus about the story of the Megillah. And on Pesach, we're all familiar with the fact that we have an obligation to talk, to elaborate, about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So what do we take from all of that, he writes? What's the takeaway message? B'chayim shalanu, he says, in our personal and private lives, yesh harbe sipurim, we have many stories to tell. L'kol achad yesh et hasipur shalo, every individual has their own story. We all have a story to tell. V'chol ha-sipurim shalanu, and all of our collective stories, hem chelek gadol me-sipur shalamenu. These are all a small unit, a small segment of a glorious, of a remarkable story of the Jewish people. We all just have a small place in a much larger context. Shemovila ta-sipur ha-gadol shel ha-historia. Our small contribution to that greater story helps to advance and to progress history forward. B'derech, he says, along the way in that story, Hayu Avosenu, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, David, Shlomo, we have so many of the greats along the way who contributed their parts to the story, V'achshav, but now, that story is up to us, V'achshav Anachnu. Now that story is up to where we are in history. Basipur Azeh, in this story, Kol Echad Yachol Lahachlit, everyone has the right to decide. Everyone has the ability to establish for themselves. If you are going to be Demut HaRashit, are you going to be an essential, an indispensable character in the story of the Jewish people? Or are you always going to be maybe a gibor, a hero, a main protagonist of our story? Or perhaps a secondary, an insignificant partner to the story of the Jewish people? Shasipur Cholef Liado, are you going to be someone that is passive as the story passes you by? Are you going to remain uninvolved and allow history to just play itself out without taking an active role, without being a major participant who is necessary to the story of the Jewish people? Hayim Ata Movil Et HaSipur Shelcha, are you advancing? Are you creating your own story, your own narrative? Hayim HaSipur Shelcha U'Sipur Tov, are you making sure that your story is a positive one, is one that's valuable to the Jewish people? Hayim HaSipur Shelcha Mechubar LeSipur Shel Am Yisrael, are you sure that your personal story is one that is connected to the history and to the larger context of the Jewish people? Hayim Hu Mekadem Otanu, is it something that advances us as a people? Do we have the ability, he writes, L'shlop B'Sipur Shelcha, to allow yourself to write your own story? Or are you allowing others to write it for you? So prophetic that he writes this, as he, only 5 years later, became an extremely important hero of the Jewish story. But his encouragement for all of us to think about where we fit into the story of the Jewish people is something that I found very profound and extremely moving. The mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim on Leil HaSeder is all about the importance of our national story. But it's a chance to remind ourselves and all those who are sitting around the Seder table with us of the sacred and eternal story of the Jewish people. It is a chance for all of us to realize, as he so beautifully writes, that we can and we must see ourselves as an individual who is part of a greater story that is the Jewish people. It's a chance to remind ourselves that we all have significant contributions to make as B'nai Chorin. We have the ability to choose, and we have the solemn obligation to do that as people who will write the next chapter of Jewish history, a part of a much larger context of everything that our nation represents. So as I mentioned last week, I was so privileged, I was so blessed to be a part of a whirlwind 3 days. It was a 72-hour trip to try to help some of the Ukrainian refugees on a mission both in Eretz Yisrael as well as in Warsaw. Our small group that was so generously sponsored and financed by the Rosenberg family of Florida, we were just a few people. We arrived in Eretz Yisrael on Monday, and we were back in New York, in JFK, on Wednesday, late evening. My mind is still in a daze from all of this. There are so many raw and painful memories mixed with completely overwhelming thoughts. And I continue to have them flowing through my mind. I hope they continue to be in the forefront of my memory, because this was so impactful. But something that really touched me to the core, so many different things did, but one thing that really did, was when we had the opportunity to meet two Chabad Shluchim from the Ukraine, from Zhytomyr in the Ukraine, who showed all of us what it means to live a life that is, as Hadar Golden writes, Mechubar L'Sipur Shel Am Yisrael. Two people who live a life that is connected, that is fully integrated, that is totally focused on the greater story of the Jewish people. These are people who showed us what it means to be a Jewish hero, what it means to be a gibor, what it means to be an essential character in the story of the Jewish people, what it means to be an indisputable part of everything that's going on in the larger story of Am Yisrael. These are people who are so noble, who have given their entire lives, taken themselves out of the equation. They have children of their own, they have families of their own, but they've made the Jewish people their life mission and their entire focus. And I'm referring to an amazing couple by the name of Rav Shlomo and Rebbetzin Esther Wilhelm. They are the father and mother of the Alumim orphanage in Zhytomyr, Ukraine. They get nothing for doing this. They started this 20 years ago just because they are warm-hearted Jews who saw that there was a need. And they went out on a shlichus to Ukraine. There are hundreds of shluchim in the Ukraine. But they decided that this was their life mission, to take in those children who had no parents and no home. They have 100 orphans under their care. They have been transplanted, they have been relocated 5 times over the last 4 weeks, continuously escaping and running. They told us about their hideouts in the Carpathian Mountains, only to then have to run into a shelter with all these children, finally to realize they have to do whatever they can to get to the border, but they didn't have papers for everybody. An amazing story, a heroic story, on the run again and again, one day after the next. And now they have finally permanently resettled in the outskirts of Beit Shemesh, where they have relocated the entire orphanage to a comfortable place where they hope that they will be able to rebuild. So we had contacted Rabbi Wilhelm before we went, and we asked how it is that we could be helpful to him and his group. Again, 100 children who have absolutely nothing, who have no parents, they have no support, they have no community, no siblings, no country, they don't speak the language, and are totally lost. And so, he told us what would be meaningful to him. We bused the entire group for their first trip to Yerushalayim. We brought them to Yerushalayim. We arranged for an elaborate hot dinner for them on the rooftop of Yeshivat Netiv Aryeh. We had musicians who came. We gave each child a gift card so they can buy clothing and essentials in retail stores that had made a deal with us beforehand. And we gave out age-appropriate gifts for each of the children, boys and girls, to bring back to the orphanage and enjoy after we were no longer going to be with them. What can I say? I don't think I've ever been part of something that was more magnificent a feeling than that. Bringing joy and bringing smiles to these children that have not had a smile on their faces for quite a long time. I brought something with me. I think this is probably the most valuable siddur I'll ever own in my life. It was a gift that these children gave us. They gave us a siddur in return. They were so overwhelmed. We all have siddurim in our homes. But to have a siddur in my talis bag now that says on it that it's a gift from the orphans of Zhytomyr, Ukraine, is something that I will cherish forever. It was amazing to spend time with these kids. There was a 16-year-old boy who was there. He approached me probably about 10 times and just couldn't stop giving me hugs. And I had no problem. After the 6th or 7th time, I finally asked him, "Are you okay? Is there anything more that you think I can do for you?" And the kid began to cry. We were speaking in Hebrew, and he said, "You have no idea what this feels like. Aside from everything else I've been through in my life, the loneliness, of not having a family, of being in this orphanage. I'd like you to know, he says, I have not had a hug from a single human being since before the start of the COVID pandemic. And I forgot, he said, I forgot what it feels like to be loved by another person. I'm so alone. Almost 3 years, he says. 2.5 years. I haven't had a hug from a single human being in the world. You have no idea what this does for my body and my soul, he said. And I told him that the hug that he was getting in return was not mine. It was an embrace of Am Yisrael. It was an embrace of the Jewish people who returned their deepest love and their support and their encouragement, who are excited for him, who have confidence in him, that he'll have the opportunities and a bright future to build a life for himself in the greatest place in the world, in Eretz Yisrael. I hope that I'll never forget the scene, dancing with 100 kids, watching them experience the Kotel for the first time, overlooking the Har HaBayis, something they heard about in imaginary worlds in Ukraine, something they never dreamt that they would be able to actually experience in their lifetime. But crying as we all locked arms and stood together in a circle, they sang V'hi She'amda together with us. I mean, just thinking about those words, that the Ribono Shel Olam saved them when so many thousands of lives are being lost, and the gift that they had of being saved and being safe in Eretz Yisrael. But all of this, while we watched Reb Shlomo and Esther Wilhelm standing in the background, really just letting everyone do their thing, and watching them selflessly commit themselves, their entire lives, to care and to nurture and educate and raise these children and provide them with all their needs. That's what it means to be a part of the much larger story of Am Yisrael. That's what it means to take myself out of the equation. It's what it means to be a Ben Chorin. A person who is an Eved, somebody who is enslaved, does not have the ability, they're not free to broaden their vision. They're very narrow-minded. There's only one thing they can focus on, the task at hand. A Ben Chorin, a free person, has the ability to write their own narrative, to look much more beyond themselves, to expand their vision, and to be so much more broad and inclusive of their own families and their own selves. You know, leading up to Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Torah tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu asks from Paro that he should give a special allowance to the Jewish people to go out and serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Finally, after a lot of back and forth, a lot of negotiating, Paro gives him this special dispensation and he says, L'chu ivdu, go out and serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Which is followed immediately by a question that Paro poses. Mi v'mia holchim. Actually, one second, slow down. Who is going to be included in this? And Paro says, I only had in mind the chuna hagvarim. This is only for the men. I don't allow all the Jewish people to go. This is a mission that's only dedicated for the men of the Jewish people. To which Moshe Rabbeinu responds, it's not the way it works. Vayomer Moshe, binarenu v'zkinenu nelech. We're going to go out with our children. We will take the youth. We're going to take everyone. Bivanenu, vivnosenu, men and women, elders, seniors. Everyone's going to come along with us. Ki chag Hashem lanu. And I think what Moshe Rabbeinu teaches all of us is that every member of the Jewish people has a part in the story of the Jewish people. We're not going to take one segment of the Jewish people out and allow them to have a rendezvous with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're going to take the entire Jewish community out. Binarenu vizkinenu. Bitsonenu vivakarenu, everything we have is going to be a part of this experience because all of us have to play a role. All of us need to be involved. All of us need to take responsibility. All of us need to show our love, our care, and our enduring commitment to each other. Just think for a minute about the opening words of Magid. When we talk about ha'alach ma'anya, when we talk about the bread of affliction, we remind ourselves what happened in Mitzrayim. And then we say, kol dichvin yeseh v'yechol. Anybody who needs should come into our home. How ironic is it that when we introduce the whole concept of chayrus, the whole idea of being free, when we highlight our ability to lead a purposeful, a meaningful life, the first thing that we do is we affirm our commitment to other people. We say that we're willing to care and show our concern for others. Anybody who doesn't have a place can come into my home. Because that's what it means to be a Ben Chorin. That's what it means to be free. That I'm engaging others, that I invite others into my home, that I look for people who don't have the privileges that I have, and I do whatever I can to enhance their lives and make them just a little bit better. That is the privilege of being a Ben Chorin. That is what it means to be free. A person who doesn't only focus on one thing that's in front of them, but someone who has the ability to choose to care, to choose to engage, to choose to love, to choose to invite, and to choose to show their support for others. It's famous that the Panavizhirov said at the time when the astronauts landed on the moon for the first time. So he made a sharp comment where he said in Hebrew, Ha'adam ulai higia le'yareach. Yes, it's true that man has made very significant scientific advancements in the world. And yes, it's true, he says, that man may have almost conquered the entire world. And even the moon, he says. And the breakthroughs and the technologies that they've come up with and the way that they've advanced the global society is amazing. But he said, Ha'adam la'adam adayin lo higia. We've made it to the moon, but we still haven't figured out how to turn to the person next to us and connect with them. And said the Panavizhirov, for many people, that's a much greater struggle than all the scientific hurdles of making it to the moon. But that is our challenge, that is our job. That's what it means, that's what we celebrate when we say, we are B'nai Chorin, we are free. Person who's free has the ability to think big, to give of their time to others, to spend their time however they choose to do so, as opposed to somebody who is enslaved, someone who is an Eved. Take a moment this Yom Tov, as you sit down to the Seder with your family or whoever is going to be with you, take a moment to appreciate what it means to be a Ben Chorin. Take a moment to think about people who don't have the ability to think in such an expansive way. Take a moment to appreciate what it means that we're free to spend our time how we choose to do it. That we're free to give of ourselves to others. That we're free to be a major part of the greater Jewish story. When we talk about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim on Leil HaSeder, the Rambam famously writes, you'll see it on the page there, B'chol dor v'dor in every generation, chayev adam laharus es atzmo, ki ilu hu be'atzmo yatza atam yishibur Mitzrayim. Says the Rambam, every generation, and it's a hard task, it's difficult, to reenact, to feel those feelings every year as if I'm coming out of Mitzrayim. It's not so easy for us to do that, but I think most people would imagine that the mitzvah, that the obligation is that we should have feelings of euphoria, we should be excited, look at this, we came out of Egypt, here we are, we're celebrating. But there's an additional aspect to the story that I think we relive and we re-experience all the time. And maybe we don't realize it. But maybe that's also part of our obligation on Leil HaSeder, to think about those moments as well. Listen to an amazing story that is shared in the Medrash, just to paint a picture of the background of this Medrash. So here are the Jewish people, they finally come out of Mitzrayim. They've lived through the most wondrous of times. They've watched all the miracles unfold, all the Eser Makos. Now they're finally free, standing in the midst of the Yam Suf. They've seen Yad Chazaka Zro Netuya, the most spectacular of miracles that the world has ever experienced. And the Gemara tells us, Mashara Shivcha Al Hayam, what the simplest person traveling through the Yam Suf at the time experienced then, was more profoundly impactful than the Nevuah of Yecheskel HaNavi. That's what was happening at the time. It was such an undeniable presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in their lives. It was so clear to them. Such an amazing revelation. And yet, listen to the shocking story, shocking conversation that the Medrash quotes that took place at that time. Let's read it together. Kivin Sheyardu L'toch Hayam. So you have the Jewish people in the middle of the dry land. They have water on each side. Hayamaletit. Obviously, there was a lot of mud on the floor. There was a lot of dirt. It was saturated with water for so many generations. And it was a little swampy, probably. Hayad akshav lachmen amayim. It was soaked with water. Suddenly it dried up and made a path for everybody to walk through. So here you have Reuven and Shimon engage in a conversation. Listen, shocking conversation. Reuven turns to his friend Shimon, they're both standing next to each other, walking through the dry land. And Reuven says, you know, I'm thinking back just a week ago to when we were in Egypt. And I'm trying to make a parallel in my mind between that experience and this. And he says, the truth is, b'mitzrayim tit uveyam tit. When we were in Egypt, we had cement all over ourselves. Our clothing was full of dirt. We were working in the fields. We were building buildings. And now here we are in the Yam Suf, and once again, we're dirty, and we have mud on our shoes, and we have dirt on our clothing. B'mitzrayim b'chomer v'levenim, when we were in Mitzrayim, we had cinder blocks, and we were building. And here, chemer mayim rabim, we have water all over the place, and it's a mess. What an amazing conversation. You're experiencing the greatest, most profound, most obvious miracles that the world has ever experienced. And where is your head? You're so narrow-minded. You're so restricted. You're so parochial. All you can see right now is the dirt on your shoes. You're not looking at Kriyas Yamsev. You're not watching anything else that's happening. The entire world is changing around you. And all you're focused on is the dirt on your shoes. Instead of appreciating how blessed they were, how fortunate they were consumed by negativity in their lives. You know, the conditions sometimes at a time of Yetzias Mitzrayim are awfully muddy. Let's be honest. So let me share with you the story of a woman by the name of Victoria, whom we met while we were in Warsaw. An amazing woman. So Victoria is a woman who was born and raised in Kharkov in Ukraine, where she grew up with her mother, and she had an uncle, Leonard. Those were the two family members that she knew of. Unfortunately, 2 years ago, her mother passed away very suddenly, and she was left only with one remaining family member, her uncle, Leonard, who became like a father to her. He raised her, he took her into the house. They spent a lot of time together. Unfortunately, a few months ago, Leonard contracted COVID, and he got a very bad case of COVID. The situation deteriorated very quickly. He ended up losing his ability to walk. He was wheelchair-bound, he was bedridden. He became incredibly weak. And just as he was starting to get stronger and have the possibility of beginning therapy, the Russians began to attack Ukraine. Now, Kharkov was attacked especially hard from many of the cities. And when most of the neighbors in their town fled to Ukraine, Victoria made a decision that she was not able to do that because she needed to stay behind for her uncle, who had stayed behind for her. Her uncle had picked her up after her mother passed away. And she felt it was inhumane for her to leave her uncle to die in the war in Ukraine. So the attacks intensified in Kharkov, and she became her uncle's full-time caretaker, risking her life to take care of him. In fact, their home, their personal home where the two of them lived, was shot at and partially destroyed from a missile. But they had no choice. They couldn't get out. There was an amazing organization by the name of Echad who are preparing complex evacuation plans for different people who need special needs more than just getting on a bus and trying to get out on their own. So they arranged for an ambulance to transport him from their home to the border outside of Ukraine. But every time they arranged to do it, it was getting delayed because there was a barrage of rockets that was coming in. And it was impossible for the ambulance to enter into the neighborhood without risking their own lives. Finally, a short window of opportunity opened up, and the ambulance entered the city of Kharkov, picked up Victoria and her uncle Leonard, and took them out to a neighboring country. They ended up going to Poland. They got to Warsaw at 4:30 a.m., listen to the date, on March 28th, last week, March 28th. A few hours later, the Israeli doctors who are volunteering in Poland, by the way, it is amazing. They told us that in Poland, there is now a 25% population increase in the last 4 weeks. You understand what that does to a town, to a city, to a community. All the hospitals are overflowing. The sewage system is overflowing. Everything. The supermarkets don't have enough food. In 4 weeks, their population rose 25%. And as a result of that, there's a team of Israeli doctors who came on their own goodwill, nobody's paying them to do that, to care for all the Jewish people who ended up in Poland because they don't want them ending up in the hospital and not being cared for. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing to see this. So they checked him out as they brought him back to Warsaw, 4:30 in the morning. It ended up that his condition had deteriorated while they were traveling from Kharkiv to the border. And these doctors had to resuscitate him because it seemed very clear that he was going to lose his life. This is after they had lost everything. This woman, Victoria, lost her mother. She had lost her home, her life, her livelihood. She's a computer programmer, a brilliant woman. And she had nothing other than the clothes on her back. So we were due to have lunch with Victoria in Warsaw on March 30th. That was part of our itinerary. Unfortunately, the first question I was asked by our tour guide when we landed in the Warsaw airport was, "Rabbi, you know, I know rabbis do all kinds of different things, but I'm just wondering, have you ever performed a tahara in your life?" I was shocked. I didn't know what he was talking about. He said, "Well, we don't have so many Jews here. Nobody here knows how to do a tahara. And I want you to know, as you were flying here from Israel to Poland, Leonard passed away. And Victoria is now alone in the world. She doesn't have a single relative that she's aware of. And through the generosity of the Rosenberg family who had financed our trip, and my older brother as well, Leonard's levaya was paid for, that he should be buried al pi halacha in a Jewish cemetery in a community where he knows no one. They also assisted Victoria in securing a home in Tekoa in Israel because she's making aliyah in 2 weeks. Gave her a very significant amount of shkalim to pay for her expenses as she gets there. We presented her with a laptop. She's a computer programmer, and we wanted to get her back onto her job so that she should be able to contribute to society in a way that she knows how to. It was amazing to speak with this woman and to see the suffering, the tragedy. So yes, it's true. The conditions of Kriyas Yamsuf are sometimes extremely muddy, extremely painful. But listen to a conversation that we had with another woman in Warsaw who just gave us such perspective. It was amazing. So one of the refugees that we spoke with, we had lunch with many, many of the refugees. We took them out. And she was a lovely woman from Kiev, which has become a household name over the last few weeks. She told us her name was Svetlana. She was shockingly calm. I don't know how anybody there was calm. But she asked if we can give her a few minutes of our attention. Now, by the way, we came to this restaurant. We had bused all of these refugees to the restaurant. Many, many people came in. We then rented out the Warsaw Cinema, which is a beautiful building, an amazing building. Took hundreds of people in to watch a Ukrainian movie. And they had a magician come and do things for the kids as well. It was absolutely amazing to see this. They're all sitting around with nothing to do all day, with no hope, with no future, with no idea, no plan, no money. It's heartbreaking to see this. And by the way, these refugees, sometimes you have an image in your mind like, "Oh, Nebuch, it's so sad." It is very sad. But what makes it even more sad and depressing is they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're nurses, they're accountants. They're all professionals. They're regular people who had normal lives and whose lives were completely destroyed for no good reason at all. Not because they did anything to deserve that. So this woman is talking to us, and as we're there by the lunch, I noticed there were two men who were there, only two men of the entire group. They were in their 40s, so I went over to them and I said, "How'd you get out? Nobody else was able to get out. How did you get out?" And they said, "The truth is, by profession, we are sailors on a cruise ship. That's what we do for a living. Happens to be when the war broke out, we were on a cruise off of the coast of Italy. We were doing our jobs. We were lucky enough that we weren't there. And we stayed behind. After the cruise was over, after we finished the job, we stayed here in Poland. We called our wives, we called our children and told them to meet us here. And they have no intention of going back, but those were the only two men we met the entire day in Warsaw. Two men, that's it. Everybody else was women and children." So this woman says that she wants to describe her personal story. And she got into all the great details of her heroic escape over the last few weeks getting out of Ukraine together with her three daughters. And she described with such elation, she was so excited to tell us that she's going to Israel on an Aliyah flight that the government is paying for. And she has many different technical challenges she asked if we can help her with. She needs the paperwork done. She couldn't figure out how to do it. We were trying to help her out. At some point she said, "You know, I left the Ukraine with nothing at all." And she points to her clothing and she says, "This shirt is what I left with. This pair of pants. This sweater and this coat. That's all I have. I don't even have a suitcase." And I was heartbroken. So I said to her, "You know, we're providing many of the people here with lots of different things that they need for essentials. Is there anything we can give you? Do you need some money to go buy some clothing?" She says, "I'll tell you the truth, I'm not even thinking about it." So I said, "How are you not thinking about it? Isn't it painful that your entire life, all you have is one change of clothing? Not a single picture, not one piece of memorabilia, nothing from your house, nothing from your blissful life that you were living in Kiev." And she said right away, "Do you think I've given one second of thought to that? Myself and my three daughters are miraculously alive. So many in my community are losing their lives and trying to run away without any success at doing so. There's nothing that we're thinking about other than the fact that we were so blessed to have been saved. Nothing else has crossed my mind." I just felt it was such a phenomenal perspective. You're in the middle of Kriyas Yamsuf. God somehow allowed you to be successful at something that so many others were not successful at doing. You have lots of mud around you. It's a horrible situation. But here's a person who taught us that there are different perspectives we can have as we go through a Kriyas Yamsuf. We can focus on the awfully muddy conditions that are in front of us, or we can focus on the miracle of Kriyas Yamsuf as it's unfolding. In fact, the very first mitzvah that the Jewish people were given as they came out of Mitzrayim was the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, the mitzvah to declare the new month and look at the moon as it's growing. And the reason for that is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to encourage all of us to realize that we have the ability to restore our lives even after they've been destroyed. When you see the Levana, when you see the moon continue to shrink until it becomes something that we can no longer see, it becomes invisible, we remind ourselves as it grows that we all have that opportunity to renew our own possibilities, to create new realities in the future, and to look at things with a new perspective. So on Tuesday evening when we were in Eretz Yisrael, before we went to Warsaw, we went to greet an Aliyah flight that was coming in to Ben Gurion from Ukraine. So they land in a separate terminal, you have to bring them your passport in advance, you have to get a clearance for it. And it was amazing to see the Israeli army helping all of these refugees off the plane, carrying their suitcases, doing everything for them. And we spoke with many, many of the people in the airport. Some of them had a broken English, some of them had a broken Hebrew. To some of them, we spoke with translators. There were people there who were helping to translate. And as we were in the airport, we distributed big sets of Playmobil toys for all the children. We sat on the floor and we were playing with the kids. And we gave out cosmetic bags and all kinds of different things for the women, with gift cards for them to buy clothing. But picture the scene. 250 people just landed from Ukraine. Not a single man on the flight under the age of 65. Not one. Every single family that was there is a wife who left her husband behind, who's heroically fighting this war. Every single family there has children who don't have a father because he's stranded behind in the Ukraine. None of them know whether they'll ever see their spouse or their father again. And again, these people were telling us that they were working professionals. They had normal lives. They were not living in some kind of ghetto somewhere. They were living in normal houses, regular communities, going to work every day, contributing members of society. And one of the women we spoke with is a mother of two young, beautiful children. And she said that she was a medical doctor in Ukraine for years. She's been on the run with her children since March 5th. 25 days straight on the run with her kids, one city to the next, trying to save her life, trying to escape danger. And every time they got to another city, the city was bombed, the city was being leveled. On March 30th, she finally made it to Ben Gurion Airport, and that is where we met her. And we asked her, "Do you know anybody in Israel? Do you have any relatives who have been here before?" She says, "No." "Have you ever visited?" "No." "I don't know anyone here," she says. "In fact," she says, "I have no idea where I'm going from the airport tonight. But," she told us, "I can say with a full heart, that I finally feel at home. Because I know this is the home of the Jewish people. And I have no idea where I'm going. But I feel at home. Because I know that this is the home of the Jewish people. These are amazing perspectives. It was unbelievable to see it and to experience it and to hear these people tell their stories. I think about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and perhaps a detail of the story that goes unnoticed is a comment that Rashi quotes in the name of Chazal. You have it on your paper at the beginning of Parshas Beshalach. Now we speak about the incredible phenomenon of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Such awe-inspiring miracles. And the hand of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was so obvious in the entire experience. But in reality, the Torah says, "V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim." Rashi quotes that chamushim means only 20% of the Jewish people actually went free. Chazal tell us that 80% of the Jewish people could not connect to the idea of what it means to be a redeemed nation. 80% of the people refused to accept the reality that freedom was even a possibility for them. 80% of the people chose to stay behind. And when we talk about all the glory of Yetzias Mitzrayim, when we talk about the amazing experience of the Man and the Be'er and the Mishkan and going into Eretz Yisrael, all of that is a description that only 20% of the nation was privileged to have. It's an experience that 80% of the people did not take part in. Those who were living in Mitzrayim at the time, imagine you turn on CNN, you turn on Fox News any day. What do you think you heard? They were hearing constant negativity. They were hearing the voices of all the cynics who said this will never happen, all the pessimists, all the news agencies telling what the popular opinion was at the time. But sometimes we need to realize that the popular opinion out there is completely off base, is not in touch with the reality. Sometimes the loud voices on social media and all these influencers who think they are so important and who give over their ideas to all of us on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else where they write op-eds, maybe they're presenting the majority opinion, the popular opinion, but sometimes maybe they're wrong. Sometimes maybe we need to think differently. And as B'nai Chorin, as a free people who have the ability to think, who have the ability to come to conclusions on our own, we look to the unshakable values of Torah and mitzvot to see what our perspective should be. We don't allow ourselves to listen to the 80% of the world that tells us to think a certain way, that tells us to act a certain way, that tells us to react a certain way. We have the ability to make calculated decisions on our own that are based on truth, that are based on upstanding values, that have proven to be correct and real over so many millennia. So again, on our day in Warsaw, we were blessed to have an opportunity to have coffee with three amazing individuals, absolutely incredible people. If you've ever been to Yad Vashem, you're familiar that there's a section for the Chasidei Umas HaOlam, for the righteous among the nations. It's a group of 27,000 Gentiles who risked their lives during the Shoah to save Jewish lives, not for any other reason than because they just felt it was the right thing to do. Today, as we speak, there are only 144 of those 27,000 that are still alive. And we had coffee one day with three of them. The oldest one alive is 102 years old, who joined us. We met with Anna, who's 94 years old and saved 36 lives. We met with Irina, who is 97 years old and saved 12 lives. And we met with Joseph, who is the oldest surviving member of this amazing club of righteous among the nations, 102 years old, saved countless lives. He snuck in every day onto the train in Warsaw to go into the ghetto. He paid off the conductors to let him off. And he brought in medications every single day and food. These people are dignified people that actually came without any help. They walked on their own. They were impeccably dressed, and they are inspiringly righteous. And we had very open dialogue, very open conversations with them. They were actually commenting on the irony that 80 years ago, growing up in Poland, they were the ones who were delivering bread and cheese and medications to all the Jews who they could. And now, 80 years later, during the COVID pandemic, they were being helped by the Jews who went out of their way to make sure that they were provided for. And they said that they had hospital visits, they had doctors coming to their homes sent by the Jews, they had bread and all the essential food sent to their homes, all their medications were picked up throughout the pandemic, all by the Jewish community who said that they felt they owed it to them for everything that they had done. What the irony of all this. It's just astounding. So they described their stories of their noble humanitarian selflessness 80 years ago in the Shoah, and their tremendous dedication to the Jewish community in Warsaw in the 1940s. And these are people, just put yourself back into their situation. These are people who more than 80% of their communities were doing one thing. Much more than 80% of their communities were doing one thing. But who courageously stood up and understood that with their fierce resolve, they had decided that they were going to live life differently. We're going to be part of the 20%. We're going to think about truth. We're going to think about the right way of life, not about the popular opinion. We're going to do what's right because we understand that it's right. Because truth must prevail at all costs, they told us. So I asked them, I actually asked this question a few times till I got an answer. They wouldn't answer my question. So I asked them, wasn't it overwhelming for you to look at a scene of millions of Jews who are being brutally murdered every single day right in front of your own eyes? What made you determine to save one life? You're looking at something that you just can't help. What are you going to do? Such colossal devastation. What's the point of saving one person when millions of Jews around you are being killed? And Joseph responded, 102 years old, he said with a clear head. He said, once I decided to live a life of truth, once I came to that determination on my own as a young man, I looked at each person I could and I decided I have to do the right thing. And he said, you cannot become overwhelmed and decide to do nothing. You always have to look for truth in your life, and you need to take action in life accordingly. And I was so touched, I was so moved by his response. And I also felt that it's so relatable to the current situation that is continuously unfolding with the refugees in Ukraine. We're watching every day on the news as cities are being bombed, as lives are being lost, as millions of people are losing their homes and being displaced. And we ask ourselves, what can I possibly do? This is an overwhelming crisis. The world is falling apart around us. You look around and there's a problem everywhere you turn. The situation is so devastating. And I'm a small person. I'm living here in the United States. What am I going to do? I don't have money to save this crisis. I don't have the resources to do that. What am I going to do? I'll get on a plane and help them. How much help is it going to be? We felt extremely uplifted by what we did. But let's be honest. We interacted with a few hundred refugees and that's it. There are millions of refugees that are displaced and need help. And Joseph told us that we need to learn to block out all the background noise. We need to learn how to look for truth with all the noise that's going on around us. Focus on one individual and realize you have the ability to impact this one life and to save it. It takes a tremendous amount of courage and determination to live a life like that. But let's challenge ourselves this Pesach to ask the same question. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. Only 20% of the Jewish people came out of Egypt and were part of the glorious story of the redemption. We ask ourselves this year on Pesach, will I, living in the age of social media, living in the age that we live in the United States in 2022, will I choose to live my life being a part of the 80% or being a part of the world that lives like the 20%? A life that stands for truth and moral values. A life that stands for something that is right, not that is popular. That is the question we ask ourselves, and that is the determination we need to have without any hesitation, without any reservation. And we need to pledge to live such a life at all costs. Look at these people and what they've done for us. Look how much courage it took. They risked their own lives. How much are we willing to stand up and say, I want to live a life that's like the 20%, even if it means I'm turning away to the 80% of public opinion? Will I have the courage to live life as a minority? to stand up for what's virtuous, for what's right, for kindness, for generosity, for a life of selflessness. This is the greatest expression of cheres. When the Rambam says that every year we have an obligation, we have the ability and we have the obligation to consider ourselves as if we've come out of Mitzrayim and we are now B'nai Chorin. It means that we're free to choose how we live life. It means we're free to make decisions how we want to make decisions. It means we're free to stand up with courage and determination. It means that we're free to use our time to help others and to be selfless people, to help enhance the lives of others. It means we're free to be a major part of the next chapter of the history of Am Yisrael. And it means we're free to choose to live a life of the 20% of the world who are principled, who are wholesome, who are honorable people, and look away from what the 80% of the world is screaming in our faces. We all look forward to the time when we'll live in a redeemed world, in a rehabilitated world, and that's what we daven for on Pesach night. Let's take the opportunity to think about what that means with all that's going on in our world. Pesach this year cannot be the same. With all that's going on, if what's on your mind is which hotel program you're going on, and which outfit you're going to wear, and which jewelry you're taking along, and where everyone's going to sit around the table, and which meats you're going to cook, it's all wonderful. We need to think about all that. But we also need to think about everything else, the larger context of what's happening in the world around us. We cannot ignore it. It's a part of our story. It's a part of who we are. It's a part of who we need to be. And we take the opportunity to wish each other that we should all have a chag kasher v'sameach, v'nochal sham min hazvachim u'min hapsachim, as we say on Leil HaSeder. We hope we'll have the opportunity to eat from the Karban Pesach, to experience Geula in Yerushalayim. Yehi ratzon shenizke, that our world should be taken me'afela li'or gadol, mishibu l'geula, v'nomar l'fanav shira chadasha. I wish everyone a chag kasher v'sameach.